The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism. Sometimes when we're on a retreat at a sesshin, time can be very odd. And no matter how long you've all been participating, and actually here in this room right now, everyone here has been participating for quite some time, coming in and out, coming and going, or being in residence. There's a sense of time being longer than it usually is, or shorter. People have been reporting that the timing of our zazen feels quicker. 25 minutes no longer seems so long. And then for some of us, it just feels like we've been here forever. And the weather is adding to that particular delusion today, because there was some time in the very recent past when it was below zero. In fact, down in the low negative 20s and 30s field temperature. Now it's up in the low 50s and raining. So spring is here. New England, at least temporarily, everything being temporary. And we say conventionally that we have one more day of our retreat left, 24 more hours until the retreat is over. And that's also a peculiar thing to say, because really, for one thing, there are an infinite number of moments between now and when we end the retreat. And to predict the future at all is unimaginable. Certainly when we started this retreat, we could never have imagined all the different things that would happen. Those of us who became sick, and then when we were sick, we could never have imagined ever getting better. And now we're better, and on it goes. Everything just unfolding the way it's supposed to. And when David and I picked this focus for this coming and going sesshin 2019 of the Lojong teachings, we didn't know where it would lead us. I think we had some idea that it would be wonderful to have little topics for all of our different Dharma talks. And it's been wonderful and also challenging to move through these teachings, which are so similar to the teachings from our Zen tradition, but also so different. And finding the common ground, and having Zen teacher Norman Fisher lead us in finding some of that common ground. But also, I think that for myself anyway, the common ground between Zen and these Lojong teachings has been found in my actual practice. What I know about the heart-mind, about bodhicitta, about what it's like to be a person who is on this path of Zen, and finding the common ground with these different pointers from our Tibetan cousins in the Mahayana. So, lots of richness, and I have to say, I find some relief coming up for me as we come to the end of the Lojong teachings. The end in quotation marks, because even in the Lojong teachings, even though they appear to go from 1 to 59, just like in the koan practice, they appear to go from 1 to 1 zillion. there's no real order. Wu Men, our ancestor, and Rinzai Zen from the 13th century, who put together the Gateless Gate collection of koans, said that there's no order to these koans. I just threw them together. There's just a bunch of different stories. And those of us who work through the Gateless Gate collection know that there is kind of an order. There's a training that the mind-heart gets trained in, one koan leading to another. The first koan being Mu, and the second one being a koan about karma, just in case you thought that understanding Mu was going to get you a free ticket to a life of perfection. Wu Men, so many years ago, says, don't be so fast. Also, we have to ground ourselves in the level of form, of consequences, of things leading from one to another. So the great koan tradition, starting with Mu, and then we examine the single-hand koans, then what we call the miscellaneous koans, which are a real in-depth training in how to speak the language of koans and prepare us for the great classical koan collections like the Gateless Gate, the Blue Cliff Record, the Book of Equanimity, the Record of the Transmission of the Light, the Five Ranks, and the Precept Koans. Those of us who have taken the precepts, we begin with the precepts, and then the koan tradition takes us at the end of our koan study, and again, end in quotation marks, to the precepts themselves as koans. And like Lojong, this is as it should be. It's a circular path. We discover more and more about the world of no form, and then we discover that the world of form and the world of no form are just one. And even if we haven't realized that, the Heart Sutra points it out to us, the elemental sutra of the Mahayana that is chanted in Tibetan practice centers and Zen practice centers everywhere all over the world on a daily basis during retreat and on a weekly basis even more than that in Zen centers, just to remind us that form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. As Hakuin Zenji reminds us in the Song of Zazen, all beings by nature are Buddha, as ice by nature is water. And we know this metaphor deeply. The ice of the cold melts into the water and the streams flowing, and the rivers of ice change to the rivers of water. And we ourselves take different forms as Buddhas. We are never the same form from moment to moment. This body that breathes in is not the same body that breathes out. And on over the years of our lives until the last out-breath. So this Zen practice, all Buddhist practices, Lojong practice, trains us to be fully human, to bring it all together. So the last few slogans begin with examine and analyze. So this is an important part of our practice. And what it means is not to sit down and figure out what's going on, but in our moment-to-moment life of practice, when things arise, we turn towards them. We turn towards them because they have all the information we need about how to act in any given moment. And examining and analyzing means recognizing, meeting patterns of reactivity, patterns of responding to the world. Norman Fisher says that this is an important part of practice because there are only two basic ways to respond to the world. One is to get enough information to see if there's actually anything we can do. And if there is something we can do, then we're required to act. And if there's nothing we can do, if the information through our examination and analysis leads us to the conclusion that there's nothing we can do, then to meet that situation of not doing. So we practice a lot of not doing in Zazen, in our sitting practice. And then we can go out into the world and feel comfortable in not doing, rather than having to frantically do all the time. This little dance between doing and not doing that culminates in doing not doing, as some of the Zen sages tell us, this is something we get to know for ourselves. I remember hearing the Dalai Lama once talk about this very succinctly. He said, I never feel regret about my actions. I don't really believe him, but at this moment he said, I never feel regret about my actions because I sit and watch the arising of my reactivity, and if I see that there's something I can do, I do it. And if I see there's nothing I can do, then I don't do it, and then there's no problem. And we might say, maybe we're not as clear as the Dalai Lama, so we still feel regret sometimes. And as I said last night, we have that wonderful Lojong slogan about keeping close to our resentment, keeping close to our regret, keeping close to the understanding that we always make the best decision we can about acting or not acting. And as we said in our Dharma dialogue the other day, we just never know. We do the best we can. And sometimes it does seem right to do what we do, and sometimes we learn pretty quickly that, oh, maybe that wasn't the right thing. We didn't have all the information. And on we go. And so we still have our repentance, gata, where we realize that everything we've ever done has been caused by countless causes and conditions. The topic of the second koan in the Gateless Gate. And then the next one is don't wallow. Don't wallow is such a great modern American instruction. Because who among us doesn't wallow? You know, two very close friends of mine who've been very sick recently have told me how impossible it is to not wallow. The sickness itself seems to have a side effect of despair and self-pity and impatience. And that's just the way it is. I think about animals getting sick, and animals just go off and bury themselves in the woods and just wait until they feel better or die. Human beings don't do that because we have the wonderful capacity to fret and wallow and make comparisons. You know, well, I just fell down the stairs and hit my head, but, you know, I should go to work. or I can barely stand up without getting dizzy, but I should go to work. I remember one of the first times I had a really bad virus when I was in my 20s, and I remember saying to the doctor, so when should I go back to work? And he looked at me and he said, you're sick. Don't go back to work. You'll go back to work when you're feeling better. You're sick. It was like he was speaking Martian. I didn't know what he was talking about. What do you mean? I'm supposed to work when it's 9 o'clock. I go to work. Yeah, so ingrained in us. So ingrained in us. So hard. And again, we don't know. We don't know. Yeah, I guess it was Corwin who said in the Dharma dialogue the other day, being sick, it seemed right to not go to work. And then it seemed right to... Oh, it was about needing and wanting. That's right. So I needed to go back to sleep. And then that shifts, and I needed to come to the temple. There's no way to know. It's impossible. And we make the best decision we can. I would say most of the time it's a mistake. Going to work, not going to work, going to sit at the temple, going to sleep. There's no way to know. So we just make our best case. And then we wallow. We feel like, oh, darn it, I shouldn't have, fill in the blank. I shouldn't have done this, that, or the other thing. How did I get so sick? How did I get into this terrible jam I'm in my life with these people? I can't believe it. And there it is. And we wallow. And one of the things Norman Fisher says elsewhere in relationship to another slogan is sometimes when the slogan begins with don't, what it's really pointing to is look and see how much you do this. So don't wallow implies to the mind wallowing is happening. And the first thing we do, hearkening back to examine and analyze, is turn towards the wallowing and say, what is this? What is this wallowing, this self-pity, this regret, this wishing it could have been different? This session that we've been on these 3 weeks, almost short one day so far, just another 23 hours to go, this has been perfect. This life that we've been living up till this moment, it's been perfect. There's no other way it could have gone. If it could have gone differently, it would have. But it went this way. And so wallowing, say, oh, I wish it had been another way. When David and I were in in Belgium last summer, we were curious about the retreat was being conducted in French. We were being translated. And we did a lot of our meetings in French, which was really interesting because I think I have about maybe 80% understanding of French, and David a little bit less. And yet we were able to communicate. It was wonderful, wonderful. But we were curious about whether there was a French conjugation, like there is in English, of would have or could have been. So it would have been better if. It could have been like this. It should have been like this. And we looked it up on the internet, and lo and behold, the name of the conjugation in English is the modal of lost opportunity. I love English grammarians. The modal of lost opportunity. This is the modal of wallowing. This is the thing that human beings do. And maybe there's a variety in French. We can discuss that later in the Dharma dialogue. But anyway, we were happy to see that in English, the modal of lost opportunity is something done quite often. It's not the past tense. It's much more complex than that. If only I, if only you, if only they. The next one is don't be jealous. And this is, of course, related to the modal of lost opportunity, too, as they're all interrelated to each other. Looking at other people and situations and wishing that you had the good luck of these other people. If only I knew what they knew. This is very common during Zen retreats because we're sitting upright and unmoving, suffering internally with how much we want to move, how much we're wallowing or planning or judging and feeling all these things. And then, you know, maybe we open our eyes and look around. Everybody else in the room is just perfectly sitting there. We don't realize that everybody else in the room is going through the same thing or some version of what we're going through because it looks so good on the outside, sitting upright like mountains. There's a great Gahan Wilson cartoon. He was a cartoonist who was also a Zen practitioner, and a lot of amazing cartoons about Zen, the Zen path, and one is showing a man at a retreat or in a zendo, sitting, you know, kind of looking around at everybody and, you know, wishing that he could sit like everybody else. And then the next panel shows that all the other people are cardboard cutouts, which he can't see. So, boy, did I knew exactly what he meant by that. So this fantasy that everyone else is a cardboard cutout or a golden statue because, oh, man, they're fantastic. Look at them. They speak up in Dharma dialogues and they sound so clever and wise and compassionate. I want to be just like fill in the blank. And Norman Fisher talks about this one as the opposite of one of the teachings from our ancestors in India and South Asia. The Brahma Viharas, which are the noble abodes that include basic friendliness and compassion being the second one, and then the third one being sympathetic joy. So in basic friendliness, we take on an attitude of welcoming everything that arrives internally and externally as if they were our guests. So the unwanted thoughts and feelings and sensations, the unwanted people, we train ourselves to meet everything with a clear, friendly attitude. And the second, and the consequence of that, learning how to do that, means that when we meet suffering, the natural arising in our hearts is compassion, of suffering with. So we realize that that our own suffering and the suffering of others is not something we have to run away from to escape, but that we can bear it together. This is one of the things that joins us together as a Sangha that we all so clearly experienced this week. As some of us went off to be sick and some of us stayed to support the Sesshin. This suffering with compassion, which is what the derivative is of the Latin root for compassion in English. Karuna in Sanskrit and Pali. suffering with. And then if we can suffer with another, then we can also enjoy the joy of others, feel the joy of others as our own. And this is sympathetic joy. And Norman Fisher says sympathetic joy is the opposite of jealousy. And I think that's completely right. And of course, by the way, the fourth Brahmavihara is equanimity, is recognizing that moment to moment things change, including the way we feel about everything. And the teachings of compassion and sympathetic joy of Karuna and Mudita are indeed the teachings of equanimity. Sometimes our hearts break, sometimes our hearts swell with fullness in the presence of what we love. And it goes back and forth and back and forth, never staying the same. Equanimity is not a steady state. It's a state of ongoing rebalancing, endless rebalancing between everything, form and emptiness, happiness and sadness, sickness and health. Equanimity is just the capacity to find balance, to bring ourselves from one brink to the other and back again. And then don't be frivolous. This stuff's serious. We're talking about life and death here. Don't get lost in thinking that that practice is a joke. It's really, really serious. And of course, it's so serious that sometimes it makes us laugh out loud. It's full of joy and humor and lightness. Frivolous is different. Frivolous is a dismissal. It's not taking into account that everything that arises contains both joy and sorrow. The wonderful poem by Naomi Shihab Nye, the American Palestinian poet who wrote Kindness, talks about this, the simultaneous arising of joys and sorrows. And if you don't know that that's true, then you can never really, really taste joy. The times when we are in desperate circumstances teach us, open our hearts to the possibility for connection and love. Frivolity is missing the other side of that formula. And sometimes things are really delightful and happy and joyous. Sometimes we watch a television comedy and just can't stop laughing and giggling. That's not what I'm talking about. And I don't think that's what this slogan's about. It's about some kind of a division, hardening the heart against the depths so that we can see everything as a joke, a cosmic joke. And of course, it is, but it's hugely funny, not amusing. So we want to make sure that we include everything and don't cut ourselves off from everything. And then we finally reach number 59, which is, don't expect applause. What a great way to end. You know, don't expect that now that you've finished studying Lojong, and just like Zen, Lojong's study is never finished. The learnings from these teachings go on and on. I'm so happy that I got to flee to them when I left my first teacher before I found James Ford and have them as a teaching and a solace between Zen teachers. That was just a great piece of luck for me. And then to return to it again when Norman Fisher's book came out, find so much inspiration from him, and then return again when we decided to do these teachings for this Sesshin. I hope I return again and again to the wisdom of these teachings. But don't think, and I'm trying not to think, and I'm pretty good at this myself, not ever thinking that I've come to the end of training. This training never comes to an end because circumstances never finalize themselves. Even when we come to our death, it should be a new thing for us. It should be, I read all the books about death, so I'm good. I know how to do this. I trained in death awareness with some lama. I'm good. No. And the same goes for Zen. We can read all the books and even finish all the koans in our particular koan curriculum. There are more koans. There are more koans from different traditions in Zen, in different collections. One of our great friends, the Belgian teacher, who is our friend Fabienne's Zen teacher, Frank Duval Roshi, we were talking to him the other day, and he told us about a koan in his miscellaneous koans that we've never done. And I just was so happy about that. We talked about it. I practiced with it for a while, got a little insight into it. Who knows if I got the insight that he would agree to. But we really need to keep the learning ongoing. And that means if there's no ending, that there's no applause, there's no like, yeah, you're done, move on to the next thing. It's, yeah, you're done with this moment. Now what? Don't expect accolades. Don't expect that also don't expect that just because you've been doing these trainings, other people are going to recognize it. I know when I first started Zen, I think when I finished my first sesshin, I was just so happy with myself, and I was sure that everyone would know how special I was. And I was really, really disturbed when people treated me like they always treated me back home. It didn't seem to be any change whatsoever in how I was being treated. I didn't get applause. You know, oh, good for you. You're a Zen student now. Mostly what I got was, how was it? Was it relaxing? Which is a very common response when you tell people you've been on a Zen retreat, because, you know, Zen is so Zen. Like the perfume and the soft drink and all the different websites, the Zen of this, that, and the other thing. And those of us who know a little bit more about this practice understand that we don't even know what Zen is, and being Zen practitioners and God, being Zen teachers, doesn't get you a lot of applause. even being Roshis, just sorry, going back to don't be jealous. Doesn't seem to make everything go smoothly. It's just another condition, another state, another title, another expectation. And so not expecting applause is a very deep teaching. Not expecting that anything will result in some kind of final acclamation. People that we know who are actors and musicians. Carol Channing just died, by the way. A wonderful, wonderful actor of the stage and screen. She talked in one of her late interviews, when she was a very old woman, about how she never lost the taste for applause. She lived for it, in a way. But anyone who performs for a living knows that applause is short-lived, and then you have to go and perform again to get some more. So not expecting it, that's a very wise thing, living our lives without any expectation of acclamation, and letting ourselves be grateful for everything that arises without expectations, but with a sense of wonder and surprise. Because sometimes we will meet the eyes of another fellow practitioner or friend or loved one, and the connection between the other person and ourselves is so clear and direct. An unexpected surprise. As Hongzhe says in the piece we read earlier this morning, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. Let wonder be your guide. So these last ones, examine and analyze. Don't wallow. Don't be jealous. Don't be frivolous. And don't expect applause. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable. A reminder that these are being recorded and posted. So if you don't want what you say to be recorded, just tell us. We'll stop here. Stop the recorder, and we'll go around and say our names. I'm Melissa.
I'm Carol.
I'm Jenny.
I'm Judith.
Susan.
Carol.
Tom Mogul.
Eric.
Greg.
I'm Corwin.
I'm Alan.
Debbie.
David.
Yeah. I was thinking about fear of missing out. It's kind of like the last opportunity. Yeah. And like a lot of times, I want to go to two events at the same time, and I'll have to miss one, or I feel like I want to have some experience that I think some other person is having, and we do a retreat day sometimes in this really neat elementary school, and I'm like, why didn't I get to go to a cool 21st century school like this? The bell was over at Corwin's flat, and I was looking at the reflection in the bell, the four meditators lined up here, and I was thinking about how would it look from the other spots, and there is no missing out. Every spot is covered. Every experience is being had. Yeah. And I've got this spot covered.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, because the mind can imagine these other things, we think they exist. But I love what you say. If we look into our experience, the whole universe, all the possible experiences right here, there is absolutely nothing we could ever miss out on. And got it covered. Thank you.
When I was looking at the Don't Expect Applause slogan and then thinking about the Dharma talk, I was really struck by something that I had never thought about before, because why would you? But, I'm in a profession where one of the things that we do is give talks. And in fact, David came to one of my talks that happened to be nearby last spring. And when you give a talk like that, people applaud at the end. That's just part of the convention. I remember some lecturers where I was a graduate student would want applause if they were teaching a great big lecture course, and they'd build an applause line into the end of the lecture, which I just thought was, not so great. And if my students ever started to apply, little danger of that, but if they ever did, I would stop them. But I was thinking how utterly shocked I would be and dismayed if people wanted to applaud at the end of a Dharma talk. And that, of course, it had never occurred to me to, but it would just be so wrong.
Yeah.
So somehow that for me is bound up with this slogan. It's like the Dharma should not be applauded.
Yeah.
The Dharma should be lived. The Dharma should be encountered. But there's no one, when the Buddha got up from under the Bodhi tree, he didn't expect anybody. So I'm just registering, how struck I am and how happy I am that we've never had applause at the end of a Dharma talk, and never will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope not.
Well, and I think there's a thing in the Dharma talk that the talk is, even though one person is speaking the talk is coming from everyone who's practicing. I have a number of friends who are ministers and clergy, and I explained to them, giving a Dharma talk is very different from a sermon, because everybody is working so hard. The admission price to get into a Dharma talk is you've got to practice. You can't just come in. Although I guess you can on retreat on this a little bit, but then you stay around and sit. But we're all working together, and what Melissa says is certainly through her wisdom, but the inspiration and the ideas and what's going on, all of us are doing. And a Dharma talk reflects that so much more than just one person.
Also, applause at, not that I'm suggesting heaven, but not in such an overt way, but we want human connection.
Right.
We want to see that we're connecting with the other person. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's that what we're saying is something that they can relate to. And so that this, at least from my end, the looking for that, you know, either in the cues, you know, the way a little bit about the head, you know, this and that, giving me a sense, okay, you know, where I'm going, you know, is people can follow and can relate to it from their own experience. I enjoy not afterwards the feedback of people, oh, that was really helpful. You know, that's sort of like, okay, it's useful. If that goes in the category of applause, then I'm guilty of it. So, but just kind of looking at you know, that deeper place.
Well, I hear you pointing to something, you know, that all these don'ts seem very, you know, hard, right? And especially in this last one. And of course we want applause. And we want affirmation. We want to know that we made a difference. That's what you're saying, right? And I'm the same way. I mean, in fact, when I gave the Dharma talk yesterday, usually at a sesshin, after a Dharma talk, the teachers go upstairs and we go, yeah, good job. it's become a thing. There was a point back in the day when one of the teachers said, let's stop doing that, because we don't really mean it, do we? And we tried, but it just was impossible. You know, not that we give a lot of feedback at that point, but we're just like, good job, you know. And yesterday, Alan wasn't here, David wasn't here, my buddies. And so I actually went in and with Mike, the assistant shoe, and said, was that okay? I needed somebody to say, yes, that was okay. And he said, oh, yeah, like, are you crazy? I think there's that, it's a human connection to affirm that. And so, I'm in total agreement with you, the longing for it. And it's not a longing to be acclaimed exactly. It's because your point, it's a longing to be met. Did this touch you in some way to have some effect? Yeah. And I have a friend who practices in a different tradition, not Buddhist tradition, but a spiritual tradition, where she has to give talks. And when she's with her teacher in India, he purposefully does not give feedback to any of the students who give talks. And she once gave what she thought was a kick-ass talk at the ashram, and the teacher was approaching her, coming down the pathway, and she was, you know, hoping, oh, this time, because it was so great, he's going to tell me that it was a really good talk, and he just walked right by her, and she immediately thought it must have been terrible, and then she sat with that for quite a while, and she realized, oh, he never gives feedback. Why should I expect? So it's along that lines too. So there's like layers of it. Yeah. Yeah.
So it just strikes me how it's in some ways. I mean, as you're saying that, you know, so much of what we do is in relation to others. And did it hit the mark? Did I get a sense? You know.
Yeah.
And it's just so basic to, you know, being social beings. And so so that's kind of a boundary to this idea of Dandi applause.
Right.
But there's another boundary, I think, which is, I was thinking about sort of at the other end of this maybe continuum or whatever, which is that, you know, it's all incredible. I mean, you know, that the sun rises or doesn't rise, the rain falls.
Oh, wait, it rose.
Somewhere. It rose.
Somewhere.
And that I can feel my heart beating, mm-hmm. and yeah. et cetera. You know, that, I mean, that's what I bow to, really. I mean,
totally.
Pardon me for another travel story, but Melissa One of the best gigs Melissa has that I get to go along is teaching in Costa Rica once a year, which we're not doing this year because our daughter's having a baby. It's this wonderful place, and she teaches 5 hours a day, and I'm the consort, which is not a bad job to have. It's on the West Coast, so we go down almost every day and watch the sunset into the sea. And it's a beautiful, sandy, isolated beach, and it's just the water temperature is gorgeous. And almost every day after the sun sets, people applaud. Like,
yay. You go, son. Nice. We particularly liked the lights. This, you know, it's good color choices. Yeah, yeah.
But it is all things, all dharmas are innately amazing, right? And sitting long and hard on retreat, we get to see that, get to touch that, and what a blessing, what a riches to see this world, to experience this world we live in. Yeah.
To appreciate.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. And Judith, you too.
Yes, well, I want to thank you for the insightful talk. Not going to applaud, but what really resonated with me was the beginning when you talked about the Dalai Lama, who said that he wouldn't regret the actions he would do because he would know when to act. And then he would act. And for me personally, I regret more often the action I don't do.
Yeah.
And when I witness some kind of injustice and I don't react, so I have more this kind of regret. And I think it was Martin Luther King who said something like, "History will remember those who remain silence in face of injustice."
Wow. I think that's such an important insight you bring in. There's something about assessing a situation, seeing there's something can be done, and then holding our... That's a very human thing. It has something to do with fear, I guess. Can you think of times when that happened for you? Was it fear that made the hesitation?
I think it's also that we do some kind of selection. We cannot take...
We can't do everything.
Every cross on our shoulders.
Yeah, that's right.
But we still notice when there are some causes. We don't adopt them and then there's injustice done. Maybe also fear.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
But I think you point out too that, you know, as our hearts open up and we actually see what's going on in the world, the injustice everywhere and the cruelty, and how do we discern what we can do? Because if we try to do everything, we won't be able to make a difference. So how can we be clear enough about what we do and we don't do, and still the things we don't do can haunt us. Wish I could do more.
And I think sometimes being a bodhisattva is not acting, but feeling the heartbreak of not acting. You know, like your regret. You know, you see this thing. I've told the story many times when I was a kid during the Vietnam War, and sit and watch the TV news with my mother, and she would just sob watching it. And I would say to her, "Why are you crying?" And she'd say, "You'll understand someday." And then I did come to understand. You know, oh my God. You know, seeing this stuff is so painful. And so the heartbreak is part of being bodhisattvas. We sometimes say are broken-hearted beings. You know, there's no way if you're really facing into all the stuff in the world you know, it's just like the other day when you mentioned the Pittsburgh bombing and you started to tear up.
The shooting.
And I think I felt, and many other people probably felt at the same time, this resonance of heartbreak there. And then what can you do? You know, right, we can't go back and change that, but very important to feel it, in my opinion. Very important to let our hearts break. So that's the another side. Not the other side, but yet another side to this regret.
And I of course, lived through the Pittsburgh situation as well, and our hearts broke. But what struck me was how beautiful the response was. You know, sort of like we keep talking about this other side, you know, of the coin or something like that, that, you know, the coming together of the community, there's a big, you know, candlelight ceremony, saying this Jewish prayers, thousands of people, collection of flowers that appeared, and everybody, that, and one of the things, the biggest things for me was these police who ran into the building, you know, as bullets were flying to save people, to save us. That just touched me. I just was so inspired and so lucky to be a part of this. You know, just there's so much health in the community.
Yeah.
And the tragedy really, without the tragedy, I don't think, you know, we notice those things.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you want to add something?
Sorry. Just that I agree with almost everything that he said. I agree with just about everything. And I guess one of the things that came up for me, and I hope this doesn't come across wrong, but what we've been talking about with Pittsburgh and all everything, you know, and with Judith's mentioning is, it brought up the other slogan, which was which is the don't wallow. It's so horrible that I couldn't help everybody.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like, what is the action that can be taken? People were, in, sorry to keep going on and on about Pittsburgh, but acupuncture, art center, with, you know, give free sessions to, you know, things would happen. People do what they can do, and there's still a lot of fear.
Well, I think that's true. Like, it's easy for me to wallow in the state of the world.
Yes.
Like, it's so dire, you know, and it doesn't, I mean, so how do we let our hearts break and not get caught
right.
in the cycle of that? So open our heart and then cry or whatever, however you do that. And then say, all right, what is it that I can do? And then do that and get some applause for doing it. Oh, wait a minute.
No, you went off the track.
I went off the track. I was close there. but when we do one thing, there is some joy in the one thing we can do. That, you know, can't do it all, but to, you know, one act, one conversation. Just like that, that covers the whole ground, right?
Yeah, right.
Nothing is left out from the one thing we do. And I hope as Zen students that, that's what we're learning here, to act fully, wholeheartedly, when we do that to, then the whole world is changed. And we participate and we are changed in it. Yeah, and so this fine line of open-hearted, see all this, but don't spend an hour a day reading the newspaper getting more and more upset about following the latest scandal, right? Like,
Well, and also, just when you were talking about, when you talked about wallowing, your whole body caved in. When you talked about acting, you sat up straight in the zazen posture.
Yeah.
And it made me think, right, zazen. you know, awareness is its own action, as John Tollefson says, right? There's some quality, like, and then, so powerful. Yeah. So that's our prescription as we go off into the rest of the retreat. So let's sit for another moment in Zazen.